My name is Dave, Zero S. This week I've been doing grading, things like that, and a little bit of programming, and working on my new website that I'm working on for myself, trying to get it polished up a little bit, and that takes a bit of time. Next on the list is Dave, K-E-0-E-A-G. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, all. It's been kind of slow this week, but I've been getting some of the magnetometer prototype boards in hand. Finally, I should get the last of them tomorrow. I've made a couple of different variants and but I think I have so far all the features that people have suggested in place. Just have to see if they work. So I've got to do some soldering. Otherwise, not a whole lot. It's been pretty snowy here today. I didn't expect to get on here at all tonight, but canceled a trip to Kansas City. So that's about it. So over to everybody else.
Fine business, Dave. And next on the list, we have Mike, AA8K, shown as recording and a mic muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerine.com, tangerinesdr.com. And next on the list is Nathan, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Things are going well here in Scranton. It's been a very busy week for me and for Rachel and Anthony. We went off to San Francisco to the American Geophysical Union meeting, and I was able to present some research on the ham-psi type of work. And also out there were Dave Kasdan and Christina Collins, and they presented a poster on the low-cost part of the ham-psi personal space weather station. And so now that I'm back here in Scranton, I'm finishing up grading final exams. The grades are due tomorrow, so I'm working on that. And I'm also working on getting the final details of the ham-psi workshop page put up. I know it's taking a long time, but there's a lot of details that need to be worked out and need to be approved. And it's just trying to get everything all in the same place, but it should be coming up very soon. So I think that's about it for right now. W2NAF, back to net.
Fine business, Nathan. And next on the list is Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening to everybody on the group. Two items. Number one is made another set of edits to the receiver schematic and send those over to Scotty. Appreciate the cover page. So we now have a cover page to the schematics, which outlines the revision tree and the referenced documents, those kinds of things. And secondly, after the discussion of the last several team speaks, there were several questions about the receiver. So I put together an application notes document, which kind of covers the various functions the receiver can be configured in, how to do those configurations, and what the applications for those different configurations might be. I haven't heard any comments back up. With the holidays, folks may not have had a chance yet to look at the document, but would appreciate it if folks would take a look at it if they're involved in the hardware or involved in the applications part of it. Back to you, Dave.
Fine business, Tom. And as usual, you keep cranking out good parts of the project, so thank you very much. Next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
All right. Thank you, Dave. And again, we appreciate you running the show as usual, the rock that holds us all together here. this week's been a little light. Also, did get a chance to take a look at ask some questions of John, and Nathaniel copied you on those, and I think you were involved in the discussion. But trying to get an idea of how they're going to do the low-cost version and help them in any way I can, because they're talking about using an FPGA, which is an interesting variant that kind of pushes them up into our territory. And I was trying to get some some information on the follow-on data engine. I know even though we aren't done with this current one, which I'm still working on, I have the plan is to come out with a Cyclone 5 A9 size, which is the largest size FPGA. It's 300,000 logic elements compared to 50,000 logic elements are in the Max 10. So the idea will be this will be the super DE, if you will, that will be able to handle lots more computing tasks than the smaller Max 10. But this looks like it's going to increase the cost by pretty much double the cost of the board. So it's not going to be our mainstream board, but it's going to be an interesting follow-on once we get the Max 10 version done. And then I did a little bit of research on how cheap could we actually make the Max 10 board if we deleted a bunch of options. And of course, you have to be careful. You delete too many options, you delete the functionality that you wanted. So I think maybe after the discussion, I got a couple questions for Nathaniel, and maybe see how that goes. Because it looks like we can decrease the cost by a significant amount at the expense of a lot of functionality, but it may be enough functionality remaining to do what the low-cost PSWS needs to be done. So that's about it for me. Back over to you, Dave.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have AB4EJ. Bill, go ahead, Bill.
Well, good evening to all. Are you copying me? I'm not sure if the system's working.
Yeah, we're copying you. You have a little bit of dropout, but very legible.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to apologize for the group for not being around the last 3 months. I've been singing in a community chorus, as most people are aware. And oddly enough, the only reason I'm here tonight was our big Christmas show with the Tuscaloosa Symphony Orchestra, with a 95-piece symphony orchestra with 200 singers on stage and a sold-out house, and canceled the whole thing because we're under a tornado watch and the university closed the campus and we couldn't use the concert hall. So that's it for this year for that. But anyway, I've been quite busy when I've been away from from our meetings. What I have done is I have started developing a prototype or a proof of concept or whatever you might call it of the software that will run on the small board computer. Main control is what I control. I call the asynchronous controller that sits in the middle of it and directs traffic. In order to actually test this thing, I had to write a second system that runs as a simulator of the data engine. I have that on a different computer so I can verify that the traffic is actually going from main control to over the net through the switch to the other device. And so I've got that working. It will respond to a lot of commands just using some assumptions on what the interface will be. And it's all that's configurable. So whatever Scotty finally comes up with for that, it'll just be an easy change to change that. And I also figured out a way to simulate the output of some signals and so on and send them over as buffers. And I can now store them into digital RF format on the small board computer. And I've also got the ring buffer working. So use case one is in proof of concept in a running system right now. I've also added the web server to this thing so you can also control it from a web interface, and I just got it working yesterday. You can also put that on yet a third computer, so it is a working proof of concept for the whole overall system that uses Flask for the web interface, and it implements everything through socket communications. The output from the DE simulator is UDP for now, until Scotty tells me I need to do something different. I am controlling the data engine simulator through a TCP data stream, with the data coming back via UDP, and I'm able to so far simulate a single channel, simulating a signal, which when you bring it up in the HDFI viewer, looks like it should. Nice sine wave there. And anyway, that's what I've been working on. I have not kept up with all of the developments. Frankly, at the time when I quit coming, it was all electrical engineering, and I felt like I really couldn't make much of a contribution, so I've been doing this. Back to Ned.
Well, fine business, Bill. And next on the list, we have Dan, W4XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave, and hello, everyone. Well, I did get the VIM3 board up and running. Haven't really done much with LinHP SDR on it yet, but I'll try to get to that a little bit later this week. Thank you, Tom, for posting the link to the Explaining Computers YouTube channel. I do watch that every once in a while. I probably watched maybe 10 episodes that he's done over the years. It's been around for a while. And I do plan to take a look at the N2 YouTube video, and we'll see what happens from that. Let's see. I guess that's about it. A beautiful day in North Carolina. We're in the upper 60s, and tomorrow's supposed to be just as nice, and then back to reality on Wednesday. So back to you, Dave.
Yes. The storm we have is headed to the East Coast, so you can expect it. But we are planning about a week of sunny weather at starting tomorrow. And since that is everybody that's here, I don't think anybody's jumped in on me. That brings us to the end of the list, so we're open for general discussion.
All right. I'd like to congratulate Bill on all that progress that you made. It sounds awesome.
I agree, Bill. You are really doing a great job with that. And I'm really sorry to hear about your concert.
Yeah, we're still under a tornado watch. And we have had a lot of big tornadoes come through here. I mean, when I first moved here, a big one came through almost on this very day. It would have been in, 1995, and destroyed a brand new Walmart that was just within a week of opening. There was nothing left but a slab. And then in 2011, a big F5 went right through the middle of downtown, took out 1,200 homes and buildings and killed 36 people. So needless to say, we're very, very paranoid about it. And that one just missed the concert hall that I'm talking about about a half a mile that time. So we don't take any chances now. If there's any tornado watch on, we just cancel everything and close the university. And I'm in a bunker now. My shack is actually in a shelter. So yeah. Anyway, we're being very careful here, but I have felt a little bit concerned that I might be working on stuff that is going to turn out to be incompatible with reality. I didn't really understand what Scotty said the last couple of minutes, because there was a dropout in, I don't know if it's on my end or his, but I did want to get a status of where he stands on, I think, what he called the LCC, that is the interface standard document between the local host and the data engine.
Okay, I didn't really say much about that. I did meet a networking expert that worked at Motorola for years and worked at OnStar, and he's retired now. So I impressed upon him the necessity of him having, you know, retirement projects are important to keep going. So he really needs to have a project to work on, and I have the perfect one for him. So I'm going to go pump his brain, because I gave a presentation at the Scottsdale Amateur Radio Club, and he was there. And he was proceeded to tell me all of the things I was doing wrong on the LCC protocol that I talked to him afterwards. So I got him to straighten me out and make sure we get something that is built with security in mind. And I do hope you get to reschedule your concert.
No, there is no plan to reschedule a concert. It's all done with paid professional performers who are already completely booked for the rest of the holiday season, so we'll just have to do it again next year. It's an annual thing. This has happened before, interestingly enough. That time that big tornado came through downtown, that evening we had been scheduled to give the B minor mass, which is glorious hours of Baroque music with an orchestra. That whole thing was canceled, and we didn't get back to it for another year. So this is just another incident of the same thing. Just by the way, Scotty, as a first implementation of this, just because this was very compatible with the way digital RF works, I'm moving a buffer from the simulator, where the 64-bit timestamp is in the first 64 bits, and then it followed by 1,064 IQ measurements that are the 32-bit floating point, and that works beautifully. It plugs into digital RF with no interpretation of the results at all. I don't have to unload the buffer and transform it in anything. So the closest we, the closer we can get to that, the less work that the SM, the small board computer, has to do while it's collecting data for the ring buffer. I just wanted to mention that. Go ahead.
So I presume you meant 1024 samples, right?
I think what you said was there's 1024 samples. If that's what you're asking, the answer is that's what I've got working now. Yes.
Okay. You said 1,064, so I presume you meant 1,024 and preceded by 64 bits of the timestamp, and then there's a timestamp present in every packet.
Yes, although here's the thing. The way digital RF works, it pays no attention to any timestamp except the very first one. The way it works is when you make the connection to digital RF and open the file, and it's not a single file, but when you do a digital RF data set create, it wants to know what the time is at that moment. And it goes through and it uses that for naming of the directories, naming of the files. And so you can look at the file and determine what time segment it came through down to the second. The main reason for having a timestamp in every one is that if we miss one or two segments, or as buffers at the very beginning of starting to collect data, we can still get an active data set without having to start everything over. What I would assume would be that the timestamp refers to the stamp, the time that the first sample pair in that buffer was taken. Go ahead.
Okay, but how am I going to know which sample pair is the first one in the buffer? I mean, I know which one's the first one in the packet, but I don't know, unless when we set up the actual stream, that first one going out is the only one that has a timestamp, or I could put in all of them, you could just ignore them in the ones you don't want.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing. That works like a champ. There's a few other things in there. There's a packet count, so I can keep an observation to know if I'm missing anything, to warn the user that there's going to be gaps in the data. I'm basically interested to know what you finally come up with for what this buffer is going to look like. And I'm just saying I've done this using some reasonable assumptions, and it can be adjusted according to how you and your Motorola buddy finally come out with. As far as data security, I'm not assuming there's going to be any data security between the data engine and the local host. I hope we can avoid a big deal on that. The reason is that is going to add a lot of a delay and overhead, which a single board computer is going to be hard pressed to do any big security operation on top of handling all that high speed data. Go ahead.
Yeah, what he was basically saying is that trying between the single board computer and the data engine is try to avoid any semblance of normal UDP or TCP traffic, because then that could be faked. But if you make it your own protocol and you put your own data inside the packets, then basically you allow the external world to come in and fake traffic to you, because they won't know what your format is anyway, and they'll be able to create packets that will get through routers in the format that need. That just by default protects you.
So that it sounds like we're going to have to write our own driver for this thing, because I've been using the library of TCP and UDP functions available in Linux. Are we going to have to write our own drivers for this thing?
I hope not. I'm trying to avoid that, but I really have to get with him and talk to him about this, because I want to come to understand what his concerns are. He's really concerned with security, and he's really thinking that I'm set myself up vulnerabilities. So I want to try and figure out how he sees those. And I mean, that's what his job has been the 20 years is, building security on top of things and really understanding how networks down to the bit level, and figuring out how to avoid some of the, and I guess what it comes down to is a lot of people, a lot of networking people take shortcuts, which lead to problems because they don't lead to consistent implementations. So they lead to scenarios that can be taken advantage of, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I've been reminded more than once recently that it's really important to think about security from the ground up with a project like this. I have less experience with this, but it sounds like it makes sense to me. And we keep seeing more and more security issues crop up as, you know, technology moves along. So it's probably something really important to think about.
Yeah, that's kind of why I want to kind of pump his brain for for what he's thinking. We might not be able to make it perfect, but if we can at least push all security over onto a single board computer, and I keep trying to tell that to him, it's like, okay, you know, if the single board computer is going to be vulnerable, people are going to be able to break into that. I basically can't do anything about that because it's like somebody breaches your firewall, you can't do anything about that, right?
Well, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, well, I guess it depends on this. I didn't think we were developing a piece of commercial equipment here, but if we are all of a sudden, and we're willing to accept the cost of that, maybe this buddy from Motorola would be willing to write all the software, because I can tell you that developing a low-level protocol that operates at a lower level than TCP and UDP is quite beyond my capabilities. It won't happen unless we have somebody like that who will provide on a volunteer basis a library that I can just call, say, make a connection, and then, okay, and by the way, also it has to work within the UL asynchronous library I'm using too.
I don't think a matter of building a commercial product or not. It's just that if we're, whether it's an amateur product or a commercial product, having it be networkable and scalable on a large scale, we need to be sensitive to these security concerns.
Yeah. Is the question where the security is applied? I'm wondering if we're all talking about the same thing here. There's a question about security between the data engine and the SBC, and I would envision that's kind of in a private area of the network. And then there's a interface between the SBC and the internet where it can upload results to a central server. And that, I think, has the security implications. Are we talking the same interface here?
Well,
I'm talking about the outside world. I'm talking about the data engine to the SBC.
Well, like I said, if your buddy from Motorola is willing to do on a volunteer basis to develop that, I'll be happy to use it. I'm just saying that I can't do it. It's beyond my skill level.
Yeah, the question is, do we need
this to try to make it doable?
Do we need a secure interface between the data engine and the SBC?
We don't necessarily need that. Motorola saying differently because he says you could get into trouble with people who deliberately make deform packets that might be interpreted as something that is your protocol when it isn't. So we just have to put the protection in there. It's maybe as simple as including some method in the data portion of our UDP packets to make sure it doesn't happen.
Scotty, your voice stream is really breaking up an awful lot, and I don't know if there's anything that you can do to make it work better, but at least from my end, I can barely understand.
Yeah, I didn't get much of that last transmission
here. It's,
yeah, Scotty, you've got about a
bad internet connection here.
Yeah, you've got about a 20% packet loss rate upstream.
Okay, well, we can talk about this later, Bill. I got your concerns. I want to talk to my networking friend, and we'll go from there.
Yeah,
I'm going to reset my internet connection here, so I'll be back.
All right. We'll be here.
I guess while we're waiting for Scotty, how's everything else going over at the University of Scranton? University of Alabama, Bill. I guess things are going to start going very soon, right?
Yes, we received our notification of the funding, and we've got a server set up that the computer science team can use to do the central command system and database. Just having a little bit of headaches trying to get the students access to it. We've got security very very tight on everything here, but I'm sure that we'll get that worked out.
Your channel timed out.
And we will get started with that first of the year. We have the students in place who are going to work on it, and I think their first job is going to be figuring out what to use for the underlying, should it be Django or should it be Flask or should it be Tomcat or what it should be. And this is something they know a lot about.
User entered your channel.
So I'm not going to stick my nose into that other than to keep track of the progress of it. I'm going to focus on getting the SBC stuff, pushing it forward. And what I'm hoping I can do is get a demo of this that will run on an Odroid, and maybe I can bring it to Orlando and demonstrate what I've got working so far, just in a corner with a couple of the guys.
That sounds really good, Bill.
Okay, I'm back here now. Does this help at all, or am I still really broken up?
You sound good.
Okay, I caught the end of that, Bill. You're going to be at Hamcation, did you say?
Yes, I'm going to be at Hamcation, and my plan is all of this will run on a single Odroid, and you just have to take my word for it that it also works if you put it on different computers. But I can demonstrate. Well, I think I need at least two computers because I don't want to have to schlep along a monitor and everything. So I'll probably bring along the Odroid and my laptop and a switch, a gigabit switch. And I can connect to the Odroid, and I've got it to where, from the web interface, I can bring up main control and reset it if anything craps out, and then I can show you how it's creating the HDF5 files and how you can configure everything from the web page and all that stuff.
I have a portable 13-inch HDMI monitor that I was planning to bring to Hamcation, and Tapper's going to have a booth there if you want to set the demo up there.
All right. Well, that is a possibility. Then we'll need a keyboard. Well, let's see. Do I really need... If we use a laptop, we don't necessarily need... I mean, I can talk to the Odroid just using the web interface and then look at other things by using an SSH connection to it. So I don't know, we can use it or we can not use it, whatever we decide.
Okay, well, I have a demo of a setup similar to what we're gonna have. It uses different DE hardware and different RF front ends, but it runs a Lin HPSDR, and I use that monitor for it. So if I bring that monitor, we at least have that. And then I'm gonna have a keyboard and a touchpad combo, the small one that uses the Logitech wireless unifying. So if you have a USB slot to plug that into, you get a keyboard and a touchpad and the monitor both, sir, all three.
Oh, that's very cool. Now, you said it was something like Lin HPSDR. What was the name of the SDR that you're using again?
It's Lin HPSDR. It's written by G0ORX. It's for Linux. And I'm running it on the Vim 3. With this 13-inch monitor, and actually I can run the whole thing on batteries. However, the batteries that I have are too big to carry on the airline, so I'm gonna bring AC power supply since we'll have AC there. So I can demo that, or we can use the display for your demo, whatever. Maybe your demo would be more interesting. And I do have a question. If you would like to talk, we've got some slots open.
Well, I'd be certainly happy to tell people what I've done so far. Although it's kind of been done, unfortunately, in isolation from the group a little bit, and I'm just turning on. How does the Lin HPSDR protocol compare with something that would run on like Pi HPSDR? Because we have running versions of that that will run on the Odroid. But I haven't tried. I've been too busy with other things to try interfacing the Raspberry Pi with this thing. It has occurred to me that I could, you know, do a discovery process like it's done with the Medicine Ozy and all that. But I haven't gotten into all that. But how does Lin HPSDR compare to Pi HPSDR?
It's basically the same, except it is optimized for Linux, and probably Dan or Dave KV0S could answer that better than I can. But the protocol it uses is the OpenHPSDR protocol, either Protocol 1 or Protocol 2, which is what our RF front end uses. So again, the hardware is similar, but it's not the same. And so I was trying to kind of, my demo would show this is, you have a data engine here, and you have an RF board here, and you have a single board computer here, and you could actually run this Linux-based HPSDR program on Linux, on the Vim3, the small board.
Okay. Dan, do you want to say something?
The programs are very similar. Pi HPSDR was basically written to take advantage of a number of external knob inputs into a single board computer, in this case a Raspberry Pi, and use that to control the radio and also to do the demodulation. And I guess the other part of it is that the issue with Lin HPSDR, in my humble opinion, is the fact that it uses the pulse radio, uses the pulse audio system in Linux, and that tends to put a lot of load on the N2. It's a good question. I will try to get the N2 up and running with Pi HPSDR. I hadn't really thought about doing that, but there's no reason why it couldn't be compiled in Raspbian as well as what we currently use, which is Ubuntu Mate for the N2.
Well, yeah, I have gotten Pi HPSDR running and talking to the Raspberry Pi on the Odroid N2. I have gotten that working. It's not working. I broke something when I regenerated the system, so it's not working at the moment. But I have done it and done all that stuff with watching the WWV's frequency move around and whatnot. So I know that you can make the Odroid N2 work with Pi HPSDR and talk to the Raspberry Pi. I don't know how that compares, because I think it's running the Open HPSDR protocol, if I understand correctly.
Yes, that's correct. The issue is Pi HPSDR has a fixed screen of 800 by 600, I believe, and it's designed to fit on the 7-inch tablet monitor for Raspberry Pi. Before John wrote Lin HPSDR, I was compiling it all on a regular Linux box because that was his newest version. But the Lin HPSDR has a scalable Windows, unlike Pi, which is fixed, and it has it doesn't address the knobs like Pi HPSDR, but it uses a regular keyboard mouse interface. So there's the Lin HPSDR is more like a regular Linux computer program. The other one has restrictions to make it fit just to the Raspberry Pi architecture.
Yeah, and it's made to run with that 7-inch touch screen, right, Dave?
Yes, that was John. It was basically they were trying to imitate something like Flex's Maestro, and that's what they did, and put it in a box and has knobs in it, and you can carry it around the house, and as long as it connects to your network system, you can tune your radio wherever it is.
Yeah, about, 4 years ago, Scotty, we actually had that up and running on a number of Raspberry Pis, and it ran fairly well. We hooked it up to our IQ2. It uses the OpenHPSDR protocol. I think he's got a setup for protocol 1 and protocol 2.
Yeah, he does. In fact, that's the demo that I have still been using to this day with the fancy cases we got with the 70s display in the front. I think you and I both have one of those. And we're using PyHP SDR from, 2016 maybe.
Yeah, it was when we went to San Francisco, I guess, was the last time that we really did much with it. That's been, 4 years ago?
Well, my main interest in it was that G0ORX really has a good handle on going through the discovery process in a very robust and bulletproof way. And I was thinking I could just basically use that, and that might give me a head start on connecting to the data engine. If the data engine's going to use that's a similar kind of thing, but I did want to ask Scotty about if we can plan on using TCP for control and UDP for data, or if everything has to be done by UDP.
I really prefer everything done by UDP, and on the control end, we would put our own acknowledges on top of UDP.
Yeah, okay. I have to redo some things then, but we'll figure it out.
Yeah, and my intent was with getting with my Motorola buddy on the networking is to really make your job as simple as we possibly can and give us adequate security. Of course, everybody argues over what's adequate. You know, is it bomb-proof or is it just probably no one will find you? And I think in a lot of the cases for my use, I'm not even going to be connected to the outside world, so I really don't care. However, that's not going to be the use for space weather stations, so we have to be a little careful.
Yeah, I mean, what we have is, as I understand correctly, a 3-port switch, and the data engine has that switch, and the SBC connects to one of those ports, and then another one goes to somebody's router, I suppose. So it could be that maybe we have the data engine sitting right on the network. Not on the open internet, but at least behind somebody's router.
Yeah, it'll be behind a router or firewall. But his name is Dave, by the way. Dave's concern was that 3-port switch will be easy to confuse. So you could do things that would get through the firewall that would be things that could mess up our protocol. And that's what he was trying to help me prevent.
Okay.
Because, I mean, technically we're behind something, but we might not be behind something that's as robust as he wanted. So, I mean, ideally, I think he'd like to see the data engine have its own port, the SBC have its own port, and put us behind some very robust firewall where he has control over what talks between us. Because his point is that this 3-port switch is, you know, a $5 piece of silicon. It's not a full-fledged router, and you don't get the protection, and you don't get encryption, you don't get things like that.
Yeah, but I would think that the protection and encryption might be better placed in front of that at the firewall level than the than behind it at the DE level.
Well, in other words, put the like what Bill said, one port goes to the SBC, one port goes to the outside world, but it's going to be the outside world via some protection.
I can't imagine having a network facing, an open internet facing port on these devices and expecting it to stand up to the slings and arrows of what all's out there. I don't know. Seems a bit much to expect.
Well, I think you can guarantee it won't stand up to it. So that's kind of what I got to talk to you about. So I didn't want to, raise the red flag here too early, because I really want to find out what he's about and find out what we really are going to absolutely have to have and what things we can live without, if any. And so that's kind of why I'm a little stalled on the protocol. But I'm more concerned with, the commands and the structure of the ACKs and things like that than actually what's inside the packet. Like we talked about the timestamp and the data. Although that's going to have to be part of it. We have to do that, but we can make it as easy as possible for Bill to integrate it with what he's got already.
Well, I mean, since I use TCP for all the commands right now, and UDP only for dumping masses of data. I have a substantial redo. Anyway, that was kind of what I was afraid you were going to say, but I was kind of implementing things the way they do in the HPSDR, where it's mostly, you know, your command stuff is by TCP, and then it's just the data is UDP. But if I can get a good flow chart on how it's supposed to work, I suppose I should be able to implement it using just UDP.
I thought HPSDR used only UDP. I wasn't aware of any TCP for them.
That is correct.
Well, the reason I say that is when I go through, okay, maybe I'm getting it confused with one of the other software-defined radios, because when I go through G0ORX's code, there's a tremendous amount of stuff being done on TCP, but maybe that's not for the OpenHPSDR.
Yeah, because from what I know, even Protocol 2 is not TCP, it's still UDP. Now, there's some artificial acts, you know, a layer above UDP that's not standard that they use, and I was planning to do a similar kind of thing, but I don't think it's TCP unless maybe he's putting some remote control kind of additions to the protocol.
He could have done that. The communications between a control program and the radio is all UDP. In Protocol 2, the big changes were to add some acknowledgments. And what they were finding is, particularly on command and control issues, they're adding some packet checks. And actually, the most recent thing implemented is a packet check, but not a true CRC.
So a packet check, you mean by checking the serial numbers to make sure you don't miss one, or some other kind of check?
Just a simple sum.
Okay, so like a CRC, but just a sum instead of the fancy.
Yeah, it's better than nothing, but it's not what we should be doing. We should probably put a real CRC in there.
CRC is not that hard when you got an FPGA. Anyway, okay.
Scotty, it was the guy who was writing the FPGA didn't know how to write the CRC.
Oh, okay. Well, all right.
You're finally getting into something that I have some extensive background on.
Well, good. Well, we're going to definitely run this by you then, because I want to make sure I don't do anything ridiculously complex for no reason. But, you know, the guy does specialize in secure networking, so I think I need to listen to him.
The problem is, when we were building HPSDR, we tried to do it as simple as possible. And at first, we would just throw packets and not even check. And if it crashed, well, you just do it again. But that was terribly confusing for users to have the whole thing crash halfway through a upload of firmware. But over time, we've gotten to make the system more robust and know when it drops a packet in programming. Now, when we receive packets from the radio, if one drops, you just forget it, throw it on the floor, and then take the next one. And you get a blip, and you just don't worry about it because it's gone, and going back and fixing it would be out of order. So that was the general philosophy.
Yeah, and I kind of agree with that, because if it's data and you miss one out of thousands, a little tick is all you might get. But if it's a command, then and I think the HPSDR didn't protect all the commands with ACTs, which I think was a mistake. And I think that's what we're going to fix here, is all the commands will be ACT, but the data will not.
Yes, and I fully agree with that. But I do think we need to put regular CRCs on commands, and particularly when you're uploading firmware, those all need to have both acknowledgments and CRCs on each packet.
Yeah, so right now I know there's packet numbers, so you can check the sequence for missing packets. There's just some on the programming packets?
The last version that I've looked at, they put just a sum, no CRC. They call it a CRC, but it's simply a sum.
Okay, well, at least they got something.
So, I mean, it's all very clear, and it's not hard to do, but it takes a while to get your head around how all the pieces interact.
Yeah, and I think, but CRC is not hard. So especially in an FPGA.
And most commercial software has lots of CRCs, and I'm sure in your proprietary package on the FPGA, there's probably some already built, but they were trying to write everything from scratch.
That's what Google is your friend.
Yep.
To back up just a little bit, on the LinHPSDR, there are a bunch of cat commands, and I'm pretty sure that that's what runs on TCP.
That would do it for sure.
Cat commands? Like concatenate, like something else?
No, for radio control.
Oh, cat computer. Okay, I got it. So I still don't think on it. I mean, Dave, you know this, and you told us this. There's no TCP/IP for the commands.
The cat protocol is TCP/IP. I mean, it's TCP.
Oh, that would be between the computer and LinHPSDR then, not between the Hermes board or the RF front end.
Yeah, it could be used in like a logging software or some other things like that. Those are appropriately TCP/IP.
Okay, well, very good. I want to switch gears for just a second and ask Nathaniel, did you see the email to John that I wrote this afternoon or this morning?
Yeah, I did. I was going to ask you about it. So it looks like you're concerned that he is getting into something that's more expensive than he thinks he is. Is that right?
Yeah, well, mostly I want to know if maybe he has some secret back door that he can come up with a cheap solution, and I want in on it.
I would love to know that, too. This is not my expertise. So if he can do it cheaper, then I'm all for it. And I guess you are, too. So I would keep dialoguing with him.
Okay, because for everyone else, we're talking about the low-cost version of the Personal Space Weather Station that receives WWV on like 9 frequencies simultaneously. And one of our meetings last week, we had a mention of using an FPGA and multiple mixer channels and a DAT and multiple ADCs to do this. And I'm going like, well, gee, that sounds an awful like Tangerine SDR. And I wanted to know how he was going to do it in the, because this is supposed to be the inexpensive version of us. So I went back and I said, okay, now if you're going to put the data engine, the RF board, plug your RF board into the data engine, and then you're going to hook the data engine up to a Raspberry Pi, say, and you only want, they only want Doppler information on 9 frequencies. So their bandwidth could be very low speed from the data engine to the Raspberry Pi. So you might use an I2C port or maybe an I2S port, something like that, to transfer the data, or even a UART for all I know. And so suppose we took the data engine and stripped every last thing off of it, except the Raspberry Pi interface and the RF board interface and the FPGA itself, how cheap could we make it? And the answer is about half price, I think. So I don't know if that would fit Dave's budget or whether Dave would be mad at John still or whether he'd be happy.
So what do we lose in terms of functionality if we strip it down all the way?
Well, the major things that you lose, you lose the local RAM storage. You lose the local QSPI, which would be for alternate FPGA images. You lose USB 3, you lose USB 2, you lose both Ethernet interfaces. You still retain the clock module, and you still retain the normal standard clock on the board, but basically you lose everything else. You still retain the RF module, so you can still plug those in. But if you're going to try to do any Ethernet or USB 3, no, you can't do that. So this is actually for use cases maybe that require a lot of FPGA number crunching, but not lots of data output, because you're going to be throttling everything down to the low-speed interface between the Raspberry Pi and the data engine. It's all got to run over that one interface, which is not very fast.
All right, that sounds good. I guess the question will be for Case Western is, does, you know, is that the cheapest way to do it? And does it meet those requirements for that low-cost personal space weather station?
Well, if he can do it cheaper than that, then I want to know about it because I want to do it that way too.
That sounds good. So then we just have to wait for his reply email, right?
Right. And I think likely is the answer is he probably hasn't thought it through that much, because, and like he said in his email, he was just kind of musing about maybe this would be a way to do it. And it's definitely a doable scenario. I mean, a doable path that he would take. It's just that I don't think he's going to get there as cheaply as he thinks.
Yeah, that sounds good. From what I've talked to Case Western so far, they have their system implemented not using FPGAs so far, and they've just recently started kicking this idea around that they could use them.
Well, they do the DSP and the Raspberry Pi. So they, I mean, what I saw was they had a single mixer and a single audio with a filter on it, and a single output that they fed into an audio input on the Raspberry Pi, and they used the sound card and a DSP algorithm to extract the carrier frequency information. Is that your idea of how it works?
That sounds about right to me.
Well, so then when I asked them, how are you going to do this 9 times, I kind of got we haven't got that far yet look. And so I'm thinking, well, suppose you took 9 mixers and you mixed them all, and you set 1 to 2.5 megahertz, 1 to 5.01 megahertz, 1 to 10.02 megahertz, 1 for 15.03 megahertz, and you offset each carrier by 10 kilohertz, mix them all together and feed them into the sound card, because it would still be an audio channel, even with, you know, maybe a wide bandwidth up to 90 kilohertz, or maybe you squeeze them together a little bit to get them into an audio bandwidth channel. Could their DSP software actually extract the information they need out of that kind of signal input?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and whether the Raspberry Pi runs out of horsepower or whether, and you know, when you start mixing all those things together and you get harmonic mixing and IMD and all that, I mean, it might just make such a big mess that you can't figure it out.
Yeah, very possible.
Especially since all the WWV frequencies, I mean, 2.5, 5, 10, 15, 20, there's lots of harmonics there.
Yeah, that's very true. Let's see. So I could probably send you a copy of the poster of what they had so far in terms of the schematic on that, and then you can take a look and see what they're doing so far.
Yeah, okay, that'd be good. I think I've looked at the schematic at DCC because they had it there, and it looked like just one NE612 mixer and a synthesizer and a selectable filter, so they could pick, you know, 1 or 4 or 5 or maybe all 9 of the WWV frequencies. They could pick one at a time, but they couldn't do more than one.
Yeah, I thought they were planning on mixing all of these things down, like you said, into one audio passband. But maybe they haven't gotten that far yet.
Well, I mean, the other alternative is they could just put 8 audio input cards on the thing. I mean, they're just USB. I don't know. I don't know if that's even possible in the operating system to do that.
And that sounds like it's adding a lot of expense very quickly.
Yeah, you know, even at $10 cards, 9 of them is $90. Well, the data engine's only going to be $100 in the stripped-down version.
Yeah, that's not working so good.
So, Dan, do you know of any multi-input sound cards that are USB?
Okay, I need to get back on. Need to get back on TeamSpeak here. Okay, so easy to listen, but not so easy to talk when you're not maintaining focus on the application. Okay, so I do not, actually.
And especially, I guess you could argue that there's some $5 and $6 sound cards of the USB, but then you're going to need 9 USB ports. So now you're going to need a hub to do that. Then you're going to have to be able to keep up with 9 streams at maybe a relatively low data rate, but still 9 streams. So I don't know. Do you think Linux can handle 9 audio inputs?
Oh, I think it probably could. I guess the question, and actually it probably depends a little bit more on the hub hardware than anything else. I think as far as the OS is concerned, it could probably handle it.
Okay, well, very good. Something to try or something to I'm just trying to help them as much as I can if there's anything I can do. Because they're kind of the predecessor to our version of the Personal Space Weather Station. So I touched upon this a little earlier. I asked Bill, since you're going to Hamcation, if you wanted to speak. I don't know if anyone else is going to Hamcation. We have a few slots that are open. If we can maybe condense it down to 1 or 2 talks, that would be awesome. Anyone else going there?
I'd like to try to go, Scotty. I need to double check, though, make sure that would be okay.
Okay.
And I'm planning on being there, I think.
Yeah, because so far we've got three space-related talks and a digital TV talk and the Tangerine SDR talk on the hardware that I'm going to do. But we could certainly have some more talk on, especially what Bill's doing, I think would may be interesting to people if it's not too far over the average ham's head.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would make sense for you and I to do a tag team thing. You could talk about the hardware and then just mention that there's a single board computer with a web interface that's going to be used. And then I could talk and actually give a demo of what I've got so far. And that would give a nice little round out to it.
So do you think you have enough material for an hour's worth of talk?
Well, it depends on how much detail you want to get into. I mean, I don't know that I have enough for an hour's worth of talk.
Is that how long the slots are, an hour?
Yeah, they do five slots in a day. And they are, it's pretty interesting because they start 45 minutes, or I'm sorry, an hour after the beginning, and they end an hour before the end. So there's not this mad rush at the beginning to try and get to the first forum or running up against the clock at the end. And they have an hour for each talk and 15 minutes in between. So for five forums, it takes 6 hours, and they have 8 hours. They put an hour on the front, an hour on the back, and each forum is 1 hour long, 60 minutes. So a little bit longer than Hamvention.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And there's one person. So each person is expected to talk for an hour.
Yeah. I mean, what they've done is they've kind of given Tapper a tech forum day. So we kind of have latitude to, if we wanted to split them, I guess we could, but we're still pretty much restricted to the an hour of someone speaking and then 15 minutes of switching the room around and then an hour of someone else speaking. So if you and I each had a half hour worth of stuff, we could tag team it for one session.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit better. I for me to come up enough stuff to talk about for a whole hour, I would have to go right down in the guts of some things that a lot of hams are not going to be interested in. But it would almost be like a code review at that point. But I don't think that's what we're looking for. I can talk about our approach to it, show them what we have so far, and actually that might be a real valuable time to get some feedback from potential users of this thing of things that maybe some design improvements that need to be made or features added, that we can really use this as a listening session or focus group. In addition to just talking about it, you know.
Say, let me remind you, Scotty's notorious for putting in, you know, usually they say a minute a slide. Well, Scotty will have 90 slides for 60 minutes.
Well, then maybe we do need 2 hours.
Yeah, I'm thinking I could use a whole hour. I've done it before. When I went in front of the Scottsdale Club, they gave me 45 minutes to talk. And I used an hour and 15 minutes. And yeah, they didn't kick me out. That's amazing.
Well, because the stuff you're talking about is interesting, I think maybe we could use 2 hours, because if you want to go in a little bit more depth, and if I want to use this as not just a demo, but also as a listening session to get feedback from the audience, that might work out to 2 hours.
Well, I'm thinking mine is... who is Tapper? What is HamSci? What are we doing together? What is the personal space weather station? There's a lot of background intro stuff that takes time, and a lot of these people, this will be the first time they've ever heard of it. So I want to keep that stuff in, so that adds enough time. So we really have kind of three topics. We have the hardware introduction that I can do. Then we have the software, which, like you said, you don't want to get into a code review. But then we also have the scientific aspect of it, which I don't really cover that well.
Yeah, the science aspect would be the part that I should work on presenting.
Yeah, that would absolutely would be the case, yes.
So we could maybe make it an hour for intro and hardware review, and then an hour for scientific and code review.
Well, I don't know about code review, but I wanted to demo what I have so far and talk about how it's put together. And some people, I'm sure, will come up with some great ideas to improve it. Any criticism they have will be most interesting to hear, because then we make it, you know, first user acceptance test occurs in alpha, in the alpha stage.
Yeah. So But I guess I was trying to indicate the split between the 2 hours. One will be intro and hardware, and the other will be software planned how we're going to roll it out and the science aspect of it. So unfortunately, they kind of go in the wrong order because the hardware goes, the hardware could go at the end. So you could do the scientific part and then maybe the software in a demo first and then do the hardware second. And that would maybe alleviate some of the introduction type stuff that I need to do.